I just went outside. You were asleep, and I went outside, I promise. Then you know where the front door is, don't you? She nodded. Reba, feel on my chest. Bring your hands up slowly. Try for his eyes. His thumb and fingers touched lightly on each side of her windpipe. Don't do what you're thinking, or I'll squeeze. Just feel on my chest. Just at my throat. Feel the key on the chain. Take it off over my head. Careful. That's right. Now I'm going to see if I can trust you. Go close the front door and lock it and bring me back the key. Go ahead. I'll wait right here. Don't try to run. I can catch you. She held the key in her hand, the chain tapping against her thigh. It was harder navigating in her shoes, but she kept them on. The ticking clock helped. Rug. Then floor. Rug again. Loom of the sofa. Go to the right. What's my best shot? Which, fool along with him, or go for it? Did the others fool along with him? She felt dizzy from deep breathing. Don't be dizzy. Don't be dead. It depends on whether the door is open. Find out where he is. Am I going right? She knew she was. It's about 5 more steps. The voice was from the bedroom, all right. She felt air on her face. The door was half open. She kept her body between the door and the voice behind her. She slipped the key in the keyhole below the knob, on the outside. Now, through the door fast, making herself pull it to and turn the key. Down the ramp, no cane, trying to remember where the van was. Running, running, into what? A bush. Screaming now, screaming, help me, help me, help me, help me. On gravel, running, a truck horn far away. Highway that way, a fast walk and trot and run, fast as she could, veering when she felt grass instead of gravel, zigging down the lane. Behind her, footsteps coming fast and hard, running in the gravel. She stooped and picked up a handful of rocks, waited until he was close, and flung them, heard them thump on him. A shove on the shoulder spun her, a big arm under her chin, around her neck, squeezing, squeezing. Blood roared in her ears. She kicked backward, hit a shin, as it became increasingly quiet. Chapter 47. In 2 hours, the list of white male employees, 20 to 50 years old, who owned vans, was completed. There were 26 names on it. Missouri DMV provided hair color from driver's license information, but it was not used as an exclusionary factor. The dragon might wear a wig. Fisk's secretary, Miss Trillman, made copies of the list and passed them around. Lieutenant Fogel was going down the list of names when his beeper went off. Fogel spoke to his headquarters briefly on the telephone, then put his hand over the receiver. "Mr. Crawford? Jack? One Ralph Mandy, white male, 38, was found shot to death a few minutes ago in University City. That's in the middle of town, close to Washington University. He was in the front yard of a house occupied by a woman named Reba McLean. The neighbor said she works for Bader. Her door's unlocked. She's not home." "Dandridge," Crawford called. "Reba McLean. What about her?"
"She works in the dark room. She's blind. She's from someplace in Colorado."
"You know a Ralph Mandy?"
"Mandy?" Dandridge said.
"Randy Mandy?"
"Ralph Mandy. He work here?"
A check of the roll showed he didn't.
"Coincidence, maybe," Fogel said.
"Maybe," Crawford said.
"I hope nothing's happened to Reba," Miss Trillman said.
"You know her?"
Graham said.
I've talked with her several times.
What about Mandy?
I don't know him. The only man I've seen her with, I saw her getting into Mr. Dollarhide's van.
Mr. Dollarhide's van, Miss Trillman? What color is Mr. Dollarhide's van?
Let's see. Dark brown, or maybe black.
Where does Mr. Dollarhide work? Crawford asked.
He's production supervisor, Fisk said.
Where's his office?
Right down the hall.
Crawford turned to speak to Graham, but he was already moving. Mr. Dollarhide's office was locked. A pass key from maintenance worked. Graham reached in and flipped on the light. He stood still in the doorway while his eyes went over the room. It was extremely neat. No personal items were anywhere in sight. The bookshelf held only technical manuals. The desk lamp was on the left side of the chair, so he was right-handed. Need a left thumbprint fast off a right-handed man.
Let's toss it for a clipboard, he said to Crawford, behind him in the hall. He'll use his left thumb on the clip.
They had started on the drawers when the desk appointment calendar caught Graham's eye. He flipped back through the scribbled pages to Saturday, June 28th, the date of the Jacoby killings. The calendar was unmarked on the Thursday and Friday before that weekend. He flipped forward to the last week in July. The Thursday and Friday were blank. There was a note on Wednesday. It said, A.M. 552-345-615. Graham copied the entry.
I want to find out where this flight goes. Let me do it. You go ahead here, Crawford said.
He went to the telephone across the hall. Graham was looking at a tube of denture adhesive in the bottom desk drawer when Crawford called from the door.
It goes to Atlanta, Will. Let's take him out.
Chapter 48 Water, cold on Reba's face, running in her hair. Dizzy. Something hard under her, sloping. She turned her head. Wood under her. A cold, wet towel wiped her face.
Are you all right, Reba?
Dollarhide's calm voice. She shied from the sound.
Breathe deeply.
A minute passed.
Do you think you can stand up? Try to stand up.
She could stand with his arm around her. Her stomach heaved. He waited until the spasm passed.
Up the ramp. Do you remember where you are?
She nodded.
Take the key out of the door, Reba. Come inside. Now lock it and put the key around my neck. Hang it around my neck. Good. Let's just be sure it's locked.
She heard the knob rattle.
That's good. Now go to the bedroom. You know the way.
She stumbled and went down on her knees, her head bowed. He lifted her by the arms and supported her into the bedroom.
Sit in this chair,
she sat.
Give her to me now.
She struggled to rise. Big hands on her shoulders held her down.
Sit still, or I can't keep him off you, Dollarhide said.
Her mind was coming back. It didn't want to.
Please try, she said. Reba, it's all over for me.
He was up, doing something. The odor of gasoline was very strong.
Put out your hand. Feel this. Don't grab it. Feel it.
She felt something like steel nostrils, slick inside, the muzzle of a gun.
That's a shotgun, Reba, a 12-gauge magnum. Do you know what it will do?
She nodded.
Take your hand down.
The cold muzzle rested in the hollow of her throat.
Reba, I wish I could have trusted you. I wanted to trust you.
He sounded like he was crying.
You felt so good.
He was crying.
So did you, Dee. I love it. Please don't hurt me now. It's all over for me. I can't leave you to him. You know what he'll do.
Bawling now.
Do you know what he'll do? He'll bite you to death. Better you go with me.
She heard a match struck, smelled sulfur, heard a whoosh. Heat in the room, smoke, fire, the thing she feared most in the world, fire. Anything was better than that. She hoped the first shot killed her. She tensed her legs to run. Blubbering.
Oh, Reba, I can't stand to watch you burn.
The muzzle left her throat. Both barrels of the shotgun went off at once as she came to her feet. Ears numbed, she thought she was shot, thought she was dead, felt the heavy thump on the floor more than she heard it. Smoke now and the crackle of flames. Fire. Fire brought her to herself. She felt heat on her arms and face. Out. She stepped on legs, stumbled, choking into the foot of the bed. Stoop low, they said, under the smoke. Don't run. You'll bump into things and die. She was locked in. Locked in, walking, stooping low, fingers trailing on the floor. She found legs. Other end. She found hair. A hairy flap. Put her hand in something soft below the hair. Only pulp. Sharp bone splinters and a loose eye in it. Key around his neck. Hurry. Both hands on the chain. Legs under her. Snatch. The chain broke and she fell backward, scrambling up again. Turned around, confused, trying to feel, trying to listen with her numbed ears over the crackle of the flames. Side of the bed. Which side? She stumbled on the body, tried to listen. Bong, bong, the clock striking. Bong, bong, into the living room. Bong, bong, take a right. Throat seared with smoke. Bong, bong. Door here. Under the knob. Don't drop it. Click the lock. Snatch it open. Air. Down the ramp. Air. Collapsed in the grass. Up again on hands and knees crawling. She came up on her knees to clap. Picked up the house echo and crawled away from it. Breathing deep until she could stand. Walk. Run until she hit something. Run again.
Chapter 49. Locating Francis Dollarhide's house was not so easy. The address listed at Gateway was a post office box in St. Charles. Even the St. Charles Sheriff's Department had to check a service map at the power company office to be sure. The Sheriff's Department welcomed St. Louis SWAT to the other side of the river, and the caravan moved quietly up State Highway 94. A deputy beside Graham in the lead car showed the way. Crawford leaned between them from the back seat and sucked at something in his teeth. They met light traffic at the north end of St. Charles, a pickup full of children, a Greyhound bus, a tow truck. They saw the glow as they cleared the northern city limits.
"That's it," the deputy said. "That's where it is."
Graham put his foot down. The glow brightened and swelled as they roared up the highway. Crawford snapped his fingers for the microphone.
"All units, that's his house burning. Watch it now. He may be coming out. Sheriff, let us have a roadblock here, if you will."
A thick column of sparks and smoke leaned southeast over the fields, hanging over them now.
"Here," the deputy said. "Turn in on this gravel."
They saw the woman then, silhouetted black against the fire, saw her as she heard them and raised her arms to them. And then the great fire blasted upward, outward, burning beams and window frames, describing slow high arcs into the night sky.
The blazing van rocked over on its side, orange tracery of the burning trees suddenly blown out and dark. The ground shuddered as the explosion, whoomp, rocked the police cars. The woman was face down in the road, Crawford and Graham and the deputies out, running to her as fire rained in the road, some running past her with their weapons drawn. Crawford took Reba from a deputy, batting sparks from her hair. He held her arms, face close to hers, red in the firelight. "Francis Dollarhide," he said. He shook her gently. "Francis Dollarhide, where is he?"
"He's in there," she said, raising her stained hand toward the heat, letting it fall.
"He's dead in there."
"You know that?" Crawford peered into her sightless eyes.
"I was with him."
"Tell me, please."
"He shot himself in the face. I put my hand in it. He set fire to the house. He shot himself. I put my hand in it. He was on the floor. I put my hand in it. Can I sit down?"
"Yes," Crawford said. He got into the back of a police car with her. He put his arms around her and let her cry into his jowl. Graham stood in the road and watched the flames until his face was red and sore. The winds aloft whipped smoke across the moon.
Chapter 50. The wind in the morning was warm and wet. It blew wisps of cloud over the blackened chimneys where Dollarhide's house had stood. Thin smoke blew flat across the fields. A few raindrops struck coals and exploded in tiny puffs of steam and ashes. A fire truck stood by, its light revolving. S. F. Ainsworth, FBI Section Chief Explosives, stood with Graham upwind of the ruins, pouring coffee from a thermos. Ainsworth winced as the local fire marshal reached into the ashes with a rake.
"Thank God it's still too hot for him in there," he said out of the side of his mouth. He had been carefully cordial to the local authorities. To Graham, he spoke his mind. "I got to wait it, hell. This place'll look like a fucking turkey farm soon as all the special deputies and constables finish their pancakes and take a crap. They'll be right on down to help."
Until Ainsworth's beloved bomb van arrived from Washington, he had to make do with what he could bring on the plane. He pulled a faded Marine Corps duffel bag out of the trunk of a patrol car and unpacked his Nomex underwear and asbestos boots and coveralls.
"What did it look like when it went up, Will?"
"A flash of intense light that died down. Then it looked darker at the base. A lot of stuff was going up. Window frames, flat pieces of the roof, and chunks flying sideways, tumbling in the fields. There was a shock wave, and the wind after. It blew out and sucked back in again. It looked like it almost blew the fire out."
"The fire was going good when it blew?"
"Yeah. It was through the roof and out the windows, upstairs and down. The trees were burning." Ainsworth recruited two local firemen to stand by with a hose, and a third, dressed in asbestos, stood by with a winch line in case something fell on him. He cleared the basement steps, now open to the sky, and went down into the tangle of black timbers. He could stay only a few minutes at a time. He made 8 trips. All he got for his effort was one flat piece of torn metal, but it seemed to make him happy. Red-faced and wet with sweat, he stripped off his asbestos clothing and sat on the running board of the fire truck with a fireman's raincoat over his shoulders. He laid the flat piece of metal on the ground and blew away a film of ash.
"Dynamite," he told Graham. "Look here. See the fern pattern in the metal? This stuff's the right gauge for a trunk or a footlocker. That's probably it. Dynamite in a footlocker. It didn't go off in the basement, though. Looks like the ground floor to me. See where the trees cut there, where that marble tabletop hit it?
blown out sideways. The dynamite was in something that kept the fire off of it for a while.
How about remains?
There may not be a lot, but there's always something. We've got a lot of sifting to do. We'll find them. I'll give them to you in a small sack.
A sedative had finally put Reba McLean to sleep at DePaul Hospital shortly after dawn. She wanted the policewoman to sit close beside her bed. Several times through the morning, she woke and reached out for the officer's hand. When she asked for breakfast, Graham brought it in. Which way to go? Sometimes it was easier for them if you were impersonal. With Reba McLean, he didn't think so. He told her who he was.
"Do you know him?" she asked the policewoman.
Graham passed the officer his credentials. She didn't need them.
"I know he's a federal officer, Miss McLean."
She told him everything, finally, all about her time with Francis Dollarhide. Her throat was sore, and she stopped frequently to suck cracked ice. He asked her the unpleasant questions, and she took him through it, once waving him out the door while the policewoman held the basin to catch her breakfast. She was pale, and her face was scrubbed and shiny when he came back into the room. He asked the last of it and closed his notebook.
"I won't put you through this again," he said, "but I'd like to come back by, just to say hi and see how you're doing."
"How could you help it, a charmer like me?" For the first time, he saw tears and realized where it ate her.
"Would you excuse us for a minute, officer?" Graham said.
He took Reba's hand. "Look here, there was plenty wrong with Dollarhide, but there's nothing wrong with you. You said he was kind and thoughtful to you. I believe it. That's what you brought out in him. At the end, he couldn't kill you, and he couldn't watch you die. People who study this kind of thing say he was trying to stop. Why? Because you helped him. That probably saved some lives. You didn't draw a freak. You drew a man with a freak on his back.
Nothing wrong with you, kid. If you let yourself believe there is, you're a sap.
I'm coming back to see you in a day or so. I have to look at cops all the time, and I need relief. Try to do something about your hair there." She shook her head and waved him toward the door. Maybe she grinned a little. He couldn't be sure.
Graham called Molly from the St. Louis FBI office. Willie's grandfather answered the telephone.
"It's Will Graham, Mama," he said. "Hello, Mr. Graham."
Willie's grandparents always called him Mr. Graham.
"Mama said he killed himself. She was looking at Donahue, and they broke in with it. Damn lucky thing. Saved you fellas a lot of trouble catching him. Saves us taxpayers footing any more bills for this thing, too. Was he really white?"
"Yes, sir. Blonde. Looked Scandinavian."
Willie's grandparents were Scandinavian.
"May I speak to Molly, please?"
"Are you going back down to Florida now?"
"Soon."
"Is Molly there?"
"Mama, he wants to speak to Molly. She's in the bathroom, Mr. Graham. My grandboy's eating breakfast again. Been out riding in that good air. You ought to see that little booger eat. I bet he's gained 10 pounds. Here she is."
"Hello."
"Hi, Hotshot."
"Good news, huh?"
"Looks like it.
I was out in the garden. My mama came out and told me when she saw it on TV.
When did you find out?"
"Late last night."
"Why didn't you call me?"
"My mama was probably asleep."
"No, she was watching Johnny Carson. I can't tell you, Will. I'm so glad you didn't have to catch him."
"I'll be here a little longer."
"Four or five days?"
"I'm not sure. Maybe not that long. I want to see you, kid."
"I want to see you, too, when you get through with everything you need to do."
"Today's Wednesday. By Friday, I ought to..."
"Will, my mama has all Willie's uncles and aunts coming down from Seattle next week, and..."
"Fuck my mama. What is this my mama, anyway?"
When Willie was a real little, he couldn't say, "Come home with me." "Will, I've waited for you. They never get to see Willie, and a few more days..."
"Come yourself. Leave Willie there, and your ex-mother-in-law can stick him on a plane next week. Tell you what, let's stop in New Orleans. There's a place called..."
"I don't think so. I've been working, just part-time, at this Western store in town, and I have to give them a little notice."
"What's wrong, Molly?"
"Nothing. Nothing's wrong. I got so sad, Will. You know, I came up here after Willie's father died." She always said, "Willie's father," as though it were an office. She never used his name. "And we were all together. I got myself together. I got calm. I've gotten myself together now, too, and I...
"Small difference. I'm not dead."
"Don't be that way."
"What way? Don't be what way? You're mad." Graham closed his eyes for a moment.
"Hello?"
"I'm not mad, Molly. You do what you want to. I'll call you when things wind up here."
"You could come up here?"
"I don't think so."
"Why not? There's plenty of room. My mama would..."
"Molly, they don't like me, and you know why. Every time they look at me, I remind them."
"That's not fair, and it's not true either."
Graham was very tired. "Okay. They're full of shit and they make me sick. Try that one."
"Don't say that.
They want the boy. Maybe they like you all right. Probably they do, if they ever think about it. But they want the boy, and they'll take you. They don't want me, and I couldn't care less. I want you in Florida. Willie, too, when he gets tired of his pony."
"You'll feel better when you get some sleep."
"I doubt it. Look, I'll call you when I know something here."
"Sure."
She hung up. "Ape shit," Graham said. "Ape shit." Crawford stuck his head in the door. "Did I hear you say ape shit?"
"You did."
"Well, cheer up. Ainsworth called in from the site. He has something for you. He said we ought to come on out. He's got some static from the locals."
Chapter 51 Ainsworth was pouring ashes carefully into new paint cans when Graham and Crawford got to the black ruin where Dollarhide's house had stood. He was covered with soot, and a large blister puffed under his ear. Special Agent Janowitz from Explosives was working down in the cellar. A tall sack of a man fidgeted beside a dusty Oldsmobile in the drive. He intercepted Crawford and Graham as they crossed the yard.
"Are you Crawford?"
"That's right."
"I'm Robert L. Delaney. I'm the coroner, and this is my jurisdiction."
He showed them his card. It said, "Vote for Robert L. Delaney." Crawford waited.
"Your man here has some evidence that should have been turned over to me. He's kept me waiting for nearly an hour."
"Sorry for the inconvenience, Mr. Delaney. He was following my instructions. Why don't you have a seat in your car and I'll clear this up?"
Delaney started after them.
Crawford turned around.
"You'll excuse us, Mr. Delaney. Have a seat in your car."
Section Chief Ainsworth was grinning, his teeth white in his sooty face. He had been sieving ashes all morning.
"As Section Chief, it gives me great pleasure to pull your prong. We all know that," Janowitz said, climbing from the black tangle of the cellar. "Silence in the ranks, Indian Janowitz. Fetch the items of interest." He tossed Janowitz a set of car keys.
From the trunk of an FBI sedan, Janowitz brought a long cardboard box. A shotgun, the stock burned off and barrels twisted by the heat, was wired to the bottom of the box. A smaller box contained a blackened automatic pistol.
"The pistol came out better," Ainsworth said. "Ballistics may be able to make a match with it. Come on, Janowitz, get to it."
Ainsworth took three plastic freezer bags from him.
"Front and center, Graham."
For a moment, the humor left Ainsworth's face. This was a hunter's ritual, like smearing Graham's forehead with blood.
That was a real sly show, partner. Ainsworth put the bags in Graham's hands. One bag contained 5 inches of a charred human femur and the ball of a hip. Another contained a wristwatch. The third held the teeth. The plate was black and broken, and only half was there, but that half contained the unmistakable pegged lateral incisor. Graham supposed he should say something. Thanks. Thanks a lot. His head swam briefly, and he relaxed all over. Museum piece, Ainsworth was saying. We have to turn it over to the turkey, don't we, Jack? Yeah, but there's some pros in the St. Louis coroner's office. They'll come over and make good impressions. We'll have those. Crawford and the others huddled with the coroner beside his car. Graham was alone with the house. He listened to the wind in the chimneys. He hoped Bloom would come here when he was well. Probably he would. Graham wanted to know about Dollarhide. He wanted to know what happened here, what bred the dragon. But he had had enough for now. A mockingbird lit on the top of a chimney and whistled. Graham whistled back. He was going home. Chapter 52. Graham smiled when he felt the jet's big push rocket him up and away from St. Louis, turning across the sun's path south and east, at last toward home. Molly and Willie would be there. Let's don't jack around about who's sorry for what. I'll pick you up in Marathon, kiddo, she said on the phone. In time, he hoped he would remember the few good moments, the satisfaction of seeing people at work who were deeply committed to their skills. He supposed you could find that anywhere if you knew enough about what you were watching. It would have been presumptuous to thank Lloyd Bowman and Beverly Katz, so he just told them on the telephone that he was glad to have worked with them again. One thing bothered him a little. The way he felt when Crawford turned from the telephone in Chicago and said, "It's Gateway." Possibly, that was the most intense and savage joy that had ever burst in him. It was unsettling to know that the happiest moment of his life had come then, in that stuffy jury room in the city of Chicago. When even before he knew... He didn't tell Lloyd Bowman how it felt. He didn't have to. You know, when his theorem rang the cherries, Pythagoras gave 100 oxen to the muse, Bowman said. Nothing sweeter, is there? Don't answer. It lasts better if you don't spend it talking. Graham grew more impatient the closer he got to home and to Molly. In Miami, he had to go out on the apron to board Aunt Lula, the old DC-3 that flew to Marathon. He liked DC-3s. He liked everything today. Aunt Lula was built when Graham was 5 years old, and her wings were always dirty with a film of oil that blew back from the engines. He had great confidence in her. He ran to her as though she had landed in a jungle clearing to rescue him. Isla Mirada's lights were coming on as the island passed under the wing. Graham could still see white caps on the Atlantic side. In minutes, they were descending to Marathon. It was like the first time he came to Marathon. He had come aboard Aunt Lula that time, too, and often afterward he went to the airfield at dusk to watch her coming in, slow and steady, flaps down, fire flickering out her exhausts, and all the passengers safe behind their lighted windows. The takeoffs were good to watch as well, but when the old airplane made her great arc to the north, it left him sad and empty, and the air was acrid with goodbyes. He learned to watch only the landings and hellos. That was before Molly. With a final grunt, the airplane swung onto the apron. Graham saw Molly and Willie standing behind the fence under the floodlights. Willie was solidly planted in front of her. He'd stay there until Graham joined them. Only then would he wander along, examining whatever interested him. Graham liked him for that. Molly was the same height as Graham, 5 feet 10 inches.
A level kiss in public carries a pleasant jolt, possibly because level kisses usually are exchanged in bed. Willie offered to carry his suitcase. Graham gave him the suit bag instead. Riding home to Sugarloaf Key, Molly driving, Graham remembered the things picked out by the headlights, imagined the rest. When he opened the car door in the yard, he could hear the sea. Willie went into the house, holding the suit bag on top of his head, the bottom flapping against the backs of his legs. Graham stood in the yard, absently brushing mosquitoes away from his face. Molly put her hand on his cheek. "What you ought to do is come on in the house before you get eaten up." He nodded. His eyes were wet. She waited a moment longer, tucked her head and peered up at him, wiggling her eyebrows. "Tanqueray martinis, steaks, hugging and stuff. Right this way. And the light bill, and the water bill, and lengthy conversations with my child," she added out of the side of her mouth. Chapter 53. Graham and Molly wanted very much for it to be the same again between them, to go on as they had before. When they saw that it was not the same, the unspoken knowledge lived with them like unwanted company in the house. The mutual assurances they tried to exchange in the dark and in the day passed through some refraction that made them miss the mark. Molly had never looked better to him. From a painful distance, he admired her unconscious grace. She tried to be good to him, but she had been to Oregon, and she had raised the dead. Willie felt it, and he was cool to Graham, maddeningly polite. A letter came from Crawford. Molly brought it in the mail and did not mention it. It contained a picture of the Sherman family, printed from movie film. Not everything had burned, Crawford's note explained. A search of the fields around the house had turned this picture up, along with a few other things the explosion had blown far from the fire. "These people were probably on his itinerary," Crawford wrote. "Safe now. Thought you'd like to know." Graham showed it to Molly. "See? That's why," he said. "That's why it was worth it." "I know," she said. "I understand that. Really, I do." The bluefish were running under the moon. Molly packed suppers, and they fished, and they built fires, and none of it was any good. Grandpa and Mamama sent Willie a picture of his pony, and he tacked it to the wall in his room. The fifth day home was the last day before Graham and Molly would go back to work in Marathon. They fished in the surf, walking a quarter mile around the curving beach to a place where they had luck before. Graham had decided to talk to both of them together. The expedition did not begin well. Willie pointedly put aside the rod Graham had rigged for him and brought the new surf-casting rod his grandfather sent home with him. They fished for 3 hours in silence. Graham opened his mouth to speak several times, but it didn't seem right. He was tired of being disliked. Graham caught 4 snappers using sand fleas for bait. Willie caught nothing. He was casting a big Rapala with 3 treble hooks, which his grandfather had given him. He was fishing too fast, casting again and again, retrieving too fast, until he was red-faced and his T-shirt stuck to him. Graham waded into the water, scooped sand in the backwash of a wave, and came up with 2 sand fleas, their legs waving from their shells. "How about one of these, partner?" He held out a sand flea to Willie. "I used the Rapala. It was my father's. Did you know that?" "No," Graham said. He glanced at Molly. She hugged her knees and looked far off at a frigate bird sailing high. She got up and brushed off the sand. "I'll go fix some sandwiches," she said. When Molly had gone, Graham was tempted to talk to the boy by himself. No. Willie would feel whatever his mother felt. He'd wait and get them both together when she came back. He'd do it this time.
She wasn't gone long, and she came back without the sandwiches, walking swiftly on the packed sand above the surf. "Jack Crawford's on the phone. I told him you'd call him back, but he said it's urgent," she said, examining a fingernail. "Better hurry." Graham blushed. He stuck the butt of his rod in the sand and trotted toward the dunes. It was quicker than going around the beach, if you carried nothing to catch in the brush. He heard a low whirring sound carried on the wind, and, wary of a rattler, he scanned the ground as he went into the scrub cedar. He saw boots beneath the brush, the glint of a lens and a flash of khaki rising. He looked into the yellow eyes of Francis Dollarhide, and fear raised the hammers of his heart. Snick of a pistol action working, an automatic coming up, and Graham kicked at it, struck it as the muzzle bloomed pale yellow in the sun, and the pistol flew into the brush. Graham, on his back, something burning in the left side of his chest, slid headfirst down the dune onto the beach. Dollarhide leaped high to land on Graham's stomach with both feet, and he had the knife out now and never looked up at the thin screaming from the water's edge. He pinned Graham with his knees, raised the knife high, and grunted as he brought it down. The blade missed Graham's eye and crunched deep into his cheek. Dollarhide rocked forward and put his weight on the handle of the knife to shove it through Graham's head. The rod whistled as Molly swung it hard at Dollarhide's face. The big Rapala's hooks sank solidly in his cheek, and the reel screamed, paying out line as she drew back to strike again. He growled, grabbed at his face as she hit him, and the treble hooks jammed into his hand as well. One hand free, one hand hooked to his face, he tugged the knife out and started after her. Graham rolled over, got to his knees, then his feet. Eyes wild and choking blood, he ran from Dollarhide, ran until he collapsed. Molly ran for the dunes, Willie ahead of her. Dollarhide was coming, dragging the rod. It caught on a bush and pulled him howling to a stop before he thought to cut the line. "Run, baby! Run, baby! Run, baby! Don't look back!" she gasped. Her legs were long, and she shoved the boy ahead of her, the crashing ever closer in the brush behind them. They had 100 yards on him when they left the dunes, 70 yards when they reached the house. Scrambling up the stairs, clawing in Will's closet, to Willie, "Stay here!" Down again to meet him, down to the kitchen, not ready, fumbling with the speed loader. She forgot the stance, and she forgot the front sight, but she got a good two-handed grip on the pistol, and as the door exploded inward, she blew a rat hole through his thigh.
"Mommy!"
And she shot him in the face, as he slid down the door facing, and she shot him in the face as he sat on the floor, and she ran to him and shot him twice in the face as he sprawled against the wall, scalp down to his chin and his hair on fire. Willie tore up a sheet and went to look for Will. His legs were shaking, and he fell several times crossing the yard. The sheriff's deputies and ambulances came before Molly ever thought to call them. She was taking a shower when they came in the house behind their pistols. She was scrubbing hard at the flecks of blood and bone on her face and hair, and she couldn't answer when a deputy tried to talk to her through the shower curtain. One of the deputies finally picked up the dangling telephone receiver and talked to Crawford in Washington, who had heard the shots and summoned them.
"I don't know. They're bringing him in now," the deputy said.
He looked out the window as the litter passed.
"It don't look good to me," he said.
Chapter 54. On the wall, at the foot of the bed, there was a clock, with numbers large enough to read through the drugs and the pain. When Will Graham could open his right eye, he saw the clock and knew where he was, an intensive care unit. He knew to watch the clock. Its movement assured him that this was passing, would pass. That's what it was there for. It said 4 o'clock.
He had no idea which 4 o'clock, and he didn't care, as long as the hands were moving. He drifted away. The clock said 8 when he opened his eye again. Someone was to the side of him. Cautiously he turned his eye. It was Molly, looking out the window. She was thin. He tried to speak, but a great ache filled the left side of his head when he moved his jaw. His head and his chest did not throb together. It was more of a syncopation. He made a noise as she left the room. The window was light when they pulled and tugged at him, and did things that made the cords in his neck stand out. Yellow light when he saw Crawford's face over him. Graham managed to wink. When Crawford grinned, Graham could see a piece of spinach between his teeth. Odd. Crawford eschewed most vegetables. Graham made writing motions on the sheet beneath his hand. Crawford slid his notebook under Graham's hand and put a pen between his fingers. "Willie, okay?" he wrote. "Yeah, he's fine," Crawford said. "Molly, too. She's been in here while you were asleep. Dollarhide's dead, Will. I promise you he's dead. I took the prints myself and had Price match them. There's no question he's dead." Graham drew a question mark on the pad. "We'll get into it. I'll be here. I can tell you the whole thing when you feel good. They only give me 5 minutes. "Now," Graham wrote. "Has the doctor talked to you?" "No. About you first?" "You'll be okay. Your eye's just swollen shut from a deep stab wound in the face. They've got it fixed, but it'll take time. They took out your spleen. But who needs a spleen? Price left his in Burma in 41. A nurse pecked on the glass. "I've got to go. They don't respect credentials, nothing around here. They just throw you out when the time's up. See you later." Molly was in the ICU waiting room. A lot of tired people were. Crawford went to her. "Molly."
"Hello, Jack," she said. "You're looking really well. Want to give him a face transplant?"
"Don't, Molly." "Did you look at him?"
"Yes."
"I didn't think I could look at him, but I did."
"They'll fix him up. The doctor told me they can do it. You want somebody to stay with you, Molly? I brought Phyllis down. She..."
"No, don't do anything else for me." She turned away, fumbling for a tissue. He saw the letter when she opened her purse, expensive mauve stationery that he had seen before. Crawford hated this. He had to do it.
"Molly?"
"What is it?"
"Will got a letter?"
"Yes."
"Did the nurse give it to you?"
"Yes, she gave it to me. They're holding some flowers from all his friends in Washington, too."
"May I see the letter?"
"I'll give it to him when he feels like it."
"Please let me see it."
"Why?"
"Because he doesn't need to hear from that particular person." Something was wrong with the expression on his face, and she looked down at the letter and dropped it, purse and all. A lipstick rolled across the floor. Stooping to pick up Molly's things, Crawford heard her heels tap fast as she left him, abandoning her purse. He gave the purse to the charge nurse. Crawford knew it would be nearly impossible for Lecter to get what he would need, but with Lecter, he took no chances. He had an intern fluoroscope the letter in the X-ray department. Crawford slit the envelope on all sides with a penknife and examined its inside surface and the note for any stain or dust. They would have lye for scrubbing at Baltimore Hospital, and there was a pharmacy. Satisfied at last, he read it. "Dear Will, here we are, you and I, languishing in our hospitals. You have your pain, and I am without my books. The learned Dr. Chilton has seen to that. We live in a primitive time, don't we, Will? Neither savage nor wise. Half measures are the curse of it. Any rational society would either kill me or give me my books. I wish you a speedy convalescence and hope
you won't be very ugly. I think of you often. Hannibal Lecter. The intern looked at his watch.
You need me anymore?
No, Crawford said. Where's the incinerator? When Crawford returned in 4 hours for the next visiting period, Molly wasn't in the waiting room, and she wasn't in the intensive care unit. Graham was awake. He drew a question mark on the pad at once. D. Dead how? He wrote under it. Crawford told him. Graham lay still for a full minute. Then he wrote, Lammed how? Okay, Crawford said. St. Louis. Dollarhide must have been looking for Reba McLean. He came in the lab while we were there and spotted us. His prints were on an open furnace room window. It wasn't reported until yesterday. Graham tapped the pad. Body? We think it was a guy named Arnold Lang. He's missing. His car was found in Memphis. It had been wiped down. They'll run me out in a minute. Let me give it to you in order. Dollarhide knew we were there. He gave us the slip at the plant and drove to a Servco Supreme station at Lindbergh in U.S. 270. Arnold Lang worked there. Reba McLean and Dollarhide had a tiff with the service station attendant on Saturday before last. We think it was Lang. He snuffed Lang and took his body to the house. Then he went to Reba McLean's. She was in a clinch with Ralph Mandy at the door. He shot Mandy and dragged him into the hedge. The nurse came in. For God's sake, it's police business, Crawford said. He talked fast as she pulled him by the coat sleeve to the door. He chloroformed Reba McLean and took her to the house. The body was there, Crawford said from the hall. Graham had to wait 4 hours to find out the rest. He gave her this and that, you know? Will I kill you or not? Crawford said as he came in the door. You know the routine about the key hanging around his neck. That was to make sure she felt the body, so she could tell us she certainly did feel a body. All right, it's this way and that way. I can't stand to see you burn, he says, and blows Lang's head off with a 12-gauge. Lang was perfect. He didn't have any teeth anyway. Maybe Dollarhide knew the maxillary arch survives fires a lot of times. Who knows what he knew? Anyway, Lang didn't have any maxillary arch after Dollarhide got through with him. He shot the head off Lang's body, and he must have tipped a chair or something for the thud of the body falling. He'd hung the key around Lang's neck. Now Reba's scrambling around looking for the key. Dollarhide's in the corner watching. Her ears are ringing from the shotgun. She won't hear his little noises. He's started a fire, but he hasn't put the gas to it yet. He's got gas in the room. She got out of the house okay. If she had panicked too much, run into a wall or something, or frozen, I guess he'd have sapped her and dragged her outside. She wouldn't have known how she got out, but she had to get out for it to work. Oh, hell, here comes that nurse. Graham wrote fast. How vehicle? You have to admire this. Crawford said. He knew he'd have to leave his van at the house. He couldn't drive two vehicles out there, and he needed a getaway piece. This is what he did. He made Lang hook up the service station tow truck to his van. He snuffed Lang, locked the station, and towed his van out to his house. Then he left the tow truck on a dirt road back in the fields behind the house, got back in his van, and went after Reba. When she got out of the house all right, he dragged out his dynamite, put the gasoline around the fire, and lammed out the back. He drove the tow truck back to the service station, left it, and got Lang's car. No loose ends. It drove me crazy until we figured it out. I know it's right, because he left a couple of prints on the tow bar. We probably met him in the road when we were going up there to the house. Yes, ma'am, I'm coming. Yes, ma'am. Graham wanted to ask a question, but it was too late. Molly took the next 5-minute visit. Graham wrote, I love you, on Crawford's pad. She nodded and held his hand. A minute later, he wrote again, Willie, okay? She nodded. Here? She looked up at him too quickly from the pad. She made a kiss with her mouth and pointed to the approaching nurse. He tugged her thumb. Where? He insisted, underlining twice. Oregon, she said. Crawford came a final time. Graham was ready with his note. It said, teeth?
his grandmother's, Crawford said. The ones we found in the house were his grandmother's. St. Louis PD located one Ned Vogt. Dollarhide's mother was Vogt's stepmother. Vogt saw Mrs. Dollarhide when he was a kid, and he never forgot the teeth. That's what I was calling you about when you ran into Dollarhide. The Smithsonian had just called me. They finally had gotten the teeth from the Missouri authorities, just to examine for their own satisfaction. They noticed the upper part was made of vulcanite instead of acrylic, like they use now. Nobody's made vulcanite plates in 35 years. Dollarhide had a new acrylic pair just like them made to fit him. The new ones were on his body. Smithsonian looked at some features on them, the fluting, they said, and rugai, Chinese manufacturer. The old ones were Swiss. He had a key on him, too, for a locker in Miami. Big book in there, kind of a diary, hell of a thing. I'll have it when you want to see it. Look, sport, I have to go back to Washington. I'll get back down here the weekend if I can. You going to be okay? Graham drew a question mark, then scratched it out and wrote, "Sure." The nurse came after Crawford left. She shot some Demerol into his intravenous line, and the clock grew fuzzy. He couldn't keep up with the second hand. He wondered if Demerol would work on your feelings. He could hold Molly a while with his face, until they finished fixing it anyway. That would be a cheap shot. Hold her for what? He was drifting off, and he hoped he wouldn't dream. He did drift between memory and dream, but it wasn't so bad. He didn't dream of Molly leaving or of Dollarhide. It was a long memory dream of Shiloh, interrupted by lights shone in his face and the gasp and hiss of the blood pressure cuff. It was spring, soon after he shot Garrett Jacob Hobbs, when Graham visited Shiloh. On a soft April day, he walked across the asphalt road to Bloody Pond. The new grass, still light green, grew down the slope to the water. The clear water had risen into the grass, and the grass was visible in the water, growing down, down, as though it covered the bottom of the pond. Graham knew what had happened there in April 1862. He sat down in the grass, felt the damp ground through his trousers. A tourist's automobile went by, and after it had passed, Graham saw movement behind it in the road. The car had broken a chicken snake's back. It slid in endless figure eights across itself in the center of the asphalt road, sometimes showing its black back, sometimes its pale belly. Shiloh's awesome presence hooded him with cold, though he was sweating in the mild spring sun. Graham got up off the grass, his trousers damp behind. He was lightheaded. The snake looped on itself. He stood over it, picked it up by the end of its smooth, dry tail, and with a long, fluid motion, cracked it like a whip. Its brains zinged into the pond. A bream rose to them. He had thought Shiloh haunted, its beauty sinister like flags. Now, drifting between memory and narcotic sleep, he saw that Shiloh was not sinister. It was indifferent. Beautiful Shiloh could witness anything. Its unforgivable beauty simply underscored the indifference of nature. The green machine. The loveliness of Shiloh mocked our plight. He roused and watched the mindless clock, but he couldn't stop thinking. In the green machine there is no mercy. We make mercy, manufacture it in the parts that have overgrown our basic reptile brain. There is no murder. We make murder, and it matters only to us. Graham knew too well that he contained all the elements to make murder, perhaps mercy too. He understood murder uncomfortably well, though. He wondered if in the great body of humankind, in the minds of men set on civilization, the vicious urges we control in ourselves, and the dark instinctive knowledge of those urges,
function like the crippled virus the body arms against. He wondered if old, awful urges are the virus that makes vaccine. Yes, he had been wrong about Shiloh. Shiloh isn't haunted. Men are haunted. Shiloh doesn't care. And I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is vexation of spirit. Ecclesiastes.
That was Red Dragon by Thomas Harris, read by Alan Sklar.
This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.